Hello and welcome back to the Fowler Hour. On today's show, I'm joined by Michael Fugoso, also known as Fug Straighter. You've probably seen some of his skeuomorphic illustrations on Instagram, and I was lucky enough to go and meet up with him in London earlier this year. I had to get him on the show as soon as I could after we spent that time together whilst those memories were still fresh. Now on today's show, we dip into topics including developing your own style, getting a traditional design education, and branching out further than just client work. We're brought to you today in part by Skillshare, a video learning platform specifically designed to take your skills to the next level. That could be in graphic design, web design, or even accounting if you really wanted to. Now to get 2 free months of unlimited lessons, simply head to skl.sh/cfowlerdesign and sign up for their free trial. It's completely free, there are no other requirements, and you can cancel that trial at any time. So again, that's skl.sh/cfowlerdesign for 2 free months of unlimited online classes. And that link is available in the show notes right now. Let's get on with the show. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Fowler Hour. Today, I am joined by Michael Fugoso from the mighty Fugstrator. You might also know him as... I know, he's smiling at me very, very nicely right now. I think I said a few nice words. How are you doing today, Michael?
I'm doing great, man. How are you? Thanks for having me on here. For sure.
Yeah. Well, I think it was, as I said, when I called you up a minute ago, I think it's appropriate to get you on now since we hung out in London a few weeks ago. It's been a couple of weeks now since we actually hung out in person. But
dude, thanks. Yeah, you showed us around. That was really nice of you to do. And I had a great time. And then there was that, you know, I started off like feeling a little queasy. So, and it just went. It was on this upward graph.
Or queasy from the amount we drunk at with Tom at the Design Cuts, or like
so.
Queasy
yeah.
From nerves.
I think it's like queasy from a lot of things because it's just a lot of it was a lot of drinking, man. I can't keep up with you guys. You guys have that young blood, you know, that young spirit. So
I mean, mate, I'm 24 and I struggle with it. Like, come on. Yeah, so for context for people listening, Lisa Jacobs and Michael came over to England for a few days. We hung out with Tom Ross at the Design Cuts office, shot some video, had a couple drinks, met all their team, and they're all amazing, lovely people. Yeah. And then we dragged this boy's ass all the way to London. And Lydia Hill, my girlfriend, Michael, Lisa, and Mark Hirons, Blue Deer Design, we hung out for a couple of days, bouncing around the town, getting a couple of drinks in the park. Which for some reason, I distinctly remember you going, I have never done this. You can drink, you can have a beer in the park on a sunny day. And I was like,
here you have to get like a water bottle or something and put vodka in it. And that's like the only way you could, you know what I mean? You got to hide it here when you go to the beach.
Is that the whole paper bag thing? Is that why people have brown paper bags?
Yeah, but now the paper bag is kind of like a tell, I think. So,
I mean, it is quite obvious, isn't it? It's just a big brown paper bag with like a tiny amount of bottle sticking out the top.
I think a trick now is to get like a Coca-Cola bottle and to do like a Jack and Coke in there. Yeah, so that's what
we were literally doing that when we were 15. Like, and you're doing that just to go and have a beer in the park.
At the park. Yeah, so now we just do it at the house, you know, house parties.
Oh, that's mate. Good. I mean,
that's a problem solving.
For sure.
Going.
Anyway, let's get away from being... I don't want anyone to think we're alcoholics because that's not the case at all. But we had a great time. We had a great time in London. And I thought now would be a great time to get Michael on the show to talk about what he does.
Oh, yeah. Let's
go. And all the incredible illustration he's been working on recently. I know you were talking about a piece you just finished. We don't have to talk about who it was for, but a piece you finished like moments before you caught your flight out to London. And that piece is really incredible. And I've been following your work kind of on and off for a long time, I realized. I went back through your feed, and there are a couple of pieces in there. I looked a couple of weeks ago before we hung out, and those few pieces, I was like, I've seen these before somewhere. And it must have been like very early Dribbble days when I was on there, kind of working out what Dribbble was. I think I'd seen your account through Instagram for a while, and... It's kind of, your work is kind of enchanting. I think it's probably one of the best ways I can describe it.
Man.
It's not just the fact that it's full of texture and depth and life, and it feels like a proper scene, but It's also the fact that you do both flat vector, minimal style, and you can expand out what you do to something that is much more textural, and I hate using the words, but touchy-feely. You know what I mean? You can actually reach into it like it would be a painting. So we're talking about this when we hung out. Now, what is your journey to becoming an illustrator up to this point? Kind of gain that type of style, something along the way must have clicked with you and you were like, this is exactly what we're going to do. So how did that style come about?
Well, let's see. How early do I start here? Okay, well,
You don't have to start as like a high school student, but we can go back that far if you want.
Well, it started when I was working at a bank. Like, I was a finance guy. Can you tell how good I am with finances and stuff?
Yeah, you look like such a robot, mate.
But yeah, I was working in finance, and I was working at, what do you call that, to have a family. I was somewhat engaged to somebody, and she was from Japan. I don't know if we talked about this.
We did a little.
Anyway, like, when that kind of didn't work out, that was when I was like, okay, I need to figure out what I need to do. Because now I have all this time, you know, like, I don't have to think about a family anymore. So I went to design school. So I actually learned the creative side, the traditional way, which is like design principles, like hierarchy, space, color. So that's how I was trained. And I went to school when I was like 29 or 30 or so. And because I was older, I think I had the mindset to kind of just take everything in as much as I can, as fast as I can. No, I live by Pirate's Code. Do you know what Pirate's Code is?
I think so, but I'd love you to indulge me. What is it?
You fall behind, you get left behind.
Oh, that's the code. That is the code.
That's Pirate's Code.
Now you've said that, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I've said that before. But it's really interesting that...
Yeah.
And I'm sure you saying that you were 29, 30 to people listening at home right now is a bit of a shock, because that's not a... traditional route. Although you went through traditional education for design, more people were doing, like, if you're going to go into design and creative fields, you typically, people think you only get one shot. People think that you have to go when you've just turned 18, you go and do 2 to 4 years of school afterwards at university, and that's it. Like, that's it, you're done. But for you had such a change in direction. Like, it's going from something that I assume is very analytical with banking to something that's so creative. So something inside you must have just ignited. And did you feel that it was odd going to university at that age? Did you think that, would it be, if someone was considering that now, would it be an option for someone else?
It would definitely be an option for someone else. And I would like to invite people to kind of think open-mindedly on a lot of things, because I was a very unorthodox person, you know. I think my whole life I was very unorthodox. I would do things slightly differently because, you know, I have that hipster vibe. You know, I've had that hipster vibe since I was a young person. And, you know, when I was in actual university, when I was studying finance and stuff, like, and I don't know why I call it actual university, but I was there for like 6 years or so. I was there for a long time.
God.
Yeah. And because I was, you know, I did a little bit of studying in Japan and study Japanese and stuff like that. So that kind of prolonged things. I met friends, and I went to this really distracting school called San Diego State University. What I mean by distracting is just, there's just beautiful people everywhere, you know.
Was this like in Japan or the States?
No, this is in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
San Diego State University. Yeah. This is where my hometown, you know. And there's like, it's just known to be a party school where there's that's where I trained my liver and everything like that, I guess.
The biggest organ in my body, my liver.
Yeah, and what I meant by beautiful people, it's like everyone is like half naked there. And
is that a requirement?
I don't know if it's like that now, because I heard it's kind of hard to get in now. It was kind of hard to get in before, but anyway, what I mean, like, when I would sit in these stadium style classrooms, right, there's always these like sorority chicks that would come in late. And then there's like only one available seat in the middle of the rows, and they'd have to like hop over everybody wearing like half, they were like half naked, and they'd have to hop over everybody to get to that chair in the middle. Sorry, this is really off tangent, but I just wanted to give you a visual.
A visual for the last, like, for 6 years of banking school.
No, but yeah, San Diego State was known. They were really good at business. And I really don't regret any of my time there because I know I started design late. But I think doing things like that traditional way and learning the business stuff and doing the things, doing a major that most people, I think, would accept, like business, engineering, being a doctor, lawyer, whatever.
It's a real job.
Yeah, it's... I think going through that really kind of helped me see what I don't like in the professional world, you know, and then going into corporate jobs and moving up a corporate ladder, learning the communication side, learning how to kind of lie to get what you want at your job. Like, you have to do that. Like, I don't know if people understand that if you want to move up in a corporate company, you kind of have to lie and exaggerate a little bit, you know, because, anyway, so that was my background and I hated it. You know, my forehead was growing bigger because talking to people about their money is like the worst thing you could do, I think. One of the worst things you could do. And then, you know, but I put up with it because, you know, I was trying to start a family. You know, that was my goal. And then when that was not in the picture anymore, it's like now I can do what I want to do. And what I wanted to do, I kind of went to design school on impulse. Because when I was very young, like in elementary school, I used to draw my characters as like Dragon Ball Z characters. You know, that was my first glimpse into client work.
You were the anime kid. We'll get onto that in a minute.
Yeah.
I want to hear about your teaching because there's an amazing story in there about anime. But we'll get that. We'll get to that in a minute.
I should probably move a bit faster on this story. But I was, I would draw my friends into Dragon Ball Z characters, and that's my first glimpse into to client work because people would be like, I don't look like that, or why do I look like the fat character in Dragon Ball Z, you know, or something like that. So,
someone gave you creative control, and you were like, you are this one.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so I don't know. It's like I was never that good at drawing, too, you know. And I think that's what I liked about design school was you don't necessarily have to be a great drawer, you know, like... I always thought being a good drawer was someone who can do those comic book things, you know what I mean? That can draw in all kinds of perspectives. I draw everything very flat, and it's very evident in my work. Everything is freaking flat, you know? And then when I went to design school, it's like, I think that you're talking about what kind of sparked in my head. I think the stuff like concentrating on composition and hierarchy and all that stuff, symmetry, asymmetry, and rules like that just really spoke to me, and it was my way to get out of that traditional artist, like drawing things in crazy perspectives or the comic book illustrator look, you know.
Because do you think that the analytical side of and the rules and the regulation type stuff associated with business and banking might have appealed to that as well? Because obviously you're talking about hierarchy, sizing, position, color, like these are not, you don't have to stick to them as like regulation rule, but they are still renowned for being design principles that you should stick to or like dodge at your peril.
Yeah.
But do you think maybe that appealed to you then?
Oh, definitely. I'm pretty sure my experiences in that like financial stick to the rules realm definitely played a part to what I'm doing now and how I see things. I also had this teacher, one of my first teachers in design school, his name was Robert. Shout out to Robert. He was the one that like he would give you a project and his project would be like, make whatever you want, you know. And he would get the worst reviews from the students because everyone was like, why don't you give us some guidelines, you know.
Some people absolutely hate it. I mean, Lydia at the moment, one of the things she talks about, Lydia, my girlfriend, she's on an illustration course, and regularly she'll be given a brief that is lackluster. So it's like, it's not a brief, it's kind of like a sentence.
Yeah.
And for some of the students in the class, they just can't handle it.
Right.
Like at all. It's just, and it kind of shows maybe your determination, but also the willingness to fail, I think, when you get given such an open brief.
Yeah, it's, and then like, it's crazy, like that teacher really, I don't know, he turned something on in my brain, I think, because he taught a lot of those basics and those principles. And his whole thing was like, you kind of have to know these things in order to break them. It's, anybody can break these rules, but in order to like have things make sense as you break these, like you have to know what the rules are first. So that's kind of how I was trained, was by this guy. And I remember I would move on to all these other teachers, but I would always come back to him, even though like it did come across as maybe a little bit of laziness for him not like really prepping a project for us. You know, he would just give us all these principles and be like, make something based off of what you've learned, you know. So I don't know, I think I appreciated that a little bit, and I liked the I like coming up with something and surprising people, and then when they look at it, they're like, you know, I had no idea you were gonna come up with that, you know. And then, and for some reason, it kind of translated to the clients I work with today. And I think I talked to you, I actually don't like really talking about this, but I'm going to say it because it's actually what I do. But I don't really do a ton of the contract stuff, a lot of the brief stuff. We kind of just go into like a hippie state of mind with the with creating the creative type stuff. We go out for drinks, and then, you know, it works to a degree. I don't recommend anyone doing this, actually. I recommend people doing it the traditional way with contracts. And I think, again, it's my background in finance and stuff, where I was dealing with all kinds of paperwork that probably mentally I wanted to shift away from that type of things and take more risks. I don't, does that make sense? Am I making
sense? It makes sense. And I'm not going to go into too much detail about exactly what your process is, but it is a little unorthodox.
Yes,
compared to what the majority of the people in the creative and design space might suggest that you do.
Yeah.
And whilst
that's why I hate saying it, is just because I know it's not really the right thing to.
I mean, I don't think it's anything you should be ashamed of, because it works. Like it works for you. Yeah. And it works time and time and time again. And the amount of times it probably doesn't work, it would probably not have worked for anyone else in the same situation. So it's probably not your process. It's probably when it goes wrong, usually it's kind of you've missed a red flag or something like that.
Right.
But your process is a little unorthodox, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work. And it doesn't mean it's like when you have the discussion of, oh, do you present three logo concepts or do you present one?
Yeah.
And that if you talk about that, like it will typically just cause an uproar. And
right.
It's not a controversial topic, but one of those tetchy topics that everyone has an opinion on. And
for sure,
when it comes to talking about your process, I think your process is really interesting, because, as you say, it's a complete contrast to what you would have done on your day-to-day job at the bank.
Right. Yeah.
Because if you're dealing with paperwork day in, day out, you'd probably, and I've met you, I can 100% tell that you much prefer dealing with people face-to-face, one-on-one, than you would sat behind a desk for 3 hours in a day writing a contract. Creating admin documents. I know you'd much rather go out and actually sit down and talk to people.
Yeah, exactly, man. I love that face-to-face. I like one-on-ones more than I like group settings too. You know, it's weird how it's like that. But I think it just has a lot to do about the things I just don't want to go back to. You know, and you know, if my goal was to make money, like I tell a lot of designers, if you want to make money, if that's your goal, if to get into this field to make money, like just like there's a ton of, I don't know how it is in the UK, but there's just a ton of real estate companies here that are all have shitty design, you know, terrible design. And they have the biggest freaking budgets out there. So like endless, bottomless pockets of a budget. So I tell people, like, if that's the goal is to make money, then do something like that. But in my case, it's like, if I wanted to make money, I would have just stayed in the financial stuff, you know? So I don't know. I guess mentally, I try to shift away from that. And I do take a lot of risks. Sometimes they don't pan out, you know, sometimes they don't. But so far, it works and it doesn't work. And then I do have a lot of struggles with that. I'm sure you'd want to talk about a lot of the struggles too. But yeah, man, I think you're nailing it. You're nailing my brain.
Well, right. I mean, it's easy. I think it's easier to nail someone's brain down when you're about four cocktails in, Michael. I really don't think that it's a conversation that should not be had, because there's nothing wrong with sitting down and going, this is different, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And particularly when it comes to the next thing that I want to talk about, which is your style and the skeuomorphism. Because from my perspective, and the sentence you've just said that caught my attention was that you don't want to go back to something. Now, let's say we're talking about admin documents. You don't want to go and do loads of paperwork. Cool, that's fine. I completely get that. But your artwork style is, as far as I'm concerned, pretty much unique, or within a very small niche. And
yeah,
the sentence of saying not something you'd want to go back to suggests that also maybe does that apply to your art style? Have you tried, or your designing style? Have you tried lots of different things and really hated them, or been forced to do a particular design style that you really didn't like, and then you've just flipped it on its head? Maybe a previous job or a previous client triggered it or something like that?
I wouldn't say it has to do with any art. I actually love all kinds of mediums of art styles. And going back to some of the flat stuff I've done before, I'd like be happy to do that. Because I would say, when I say I don't like going back to things, it's maybe the things that like just gave me these negative experiences. Like, I would never go back to web design. You know, I was also trained in web, and I could code you a website. If you point a gun to my head, you know, I can, whatever, jQuery, JavaScript, and all that stuff. Like, that's what I was trained for, that and PHP. Like, I could do all that. But I hated those courses. It was funny, man. When I was in school, I graduated school as a valedictorian in my class. But I had 1B. So I had a lesser GPA than someone, but they gave me the valedictorian thing anyway. And then that 1B I got was in PHP.
In PHP, really? Yeah. Of all the things, like, thinking about the career that you've kind of built for yourself now, the fact that PHP was your downfall in university.
It was just a really hard thing for me to grasp. It was super dry, and
yeah, I don't touch your stuff. Like, I have a basic awareness of a majority or a large set of coding languages and what they do, but I have no desire to touch them. I have no desire to code. I have no desire to write language. Yeah.
You'd rather work with a specialist that can help you out, and then you can speak for those languages and stuff.
Yeah, let me push a button and give you some money. Go.
Right. So I think, yeah, when I say I don't want to go back to things, it's more of those... like, I don't think anything in art so far has caused me any grief. Maybe I'm just not thinking about it right now, but I really like working in all kinds of styles. Oh, you know what I don't like doing in the illustrative space is, like, I don't like drawing things in perspective.
Yeah, we like the flat style.
Yeah, so, I like the really flat communicative
style. So where did it come from? Where did the skeuomorphism come from?
So the
if it wasn't triggered by something you didn't like, because from my perspective, understanding an art style, often people develop it over a long period of time just through experimentation, or they see what is out there that's kind of saturated, and they go, well, I'm just going to do the complete opposite of that.
Right. Well, you know what? If I were to think about where it came from, I'd say it's probably because, you know, I'm like an 80s dude. You know what I mean? I like the 80s look, the 80s style, and I'm also an early 90s guy, which is kind of 80s. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles back then, and when they made that new Bumblebee movie, have you seen Bumblebee?
I have not, but I am fully aware of the whole new Transformers universe anyway.
Bumblebee was fine. I'm like, finally you guys paid respect to the old stuff, because it was set in the 80s. The robots looked like they did back then, you know, kind of. And it was like stuff like that just really... I told this to someone, I forgot what I said, but I said my goal when I create stuff is to give people that feeling like, oh, shoot, explosions, boom, freaking cool. It hits my childhood, whatever. And then they would also... it would also be classy enough to hang on their wall. Like, that's kind of the goal I have in mind. But I think a lot of the skeuomorphic stuff comes from the stuff I liked back in the day. Like, are you old enough to have had a Super Nintendo?
I actually own one right now. There's one upstairs. I didn't have one growing up as a kid, but I was part of the chiptune music scene for a while.
That's right. We were talking about this. Yeah.
So yeah, no, I'm well aware of that stuff.
Yeah. And when I ask you if you're old enough for things, I don't mean that in a disrespectful manner or anything. I just, like, you know, I'm pretty old.
How old are you again?
But like, I don't know if you remember the old school Super Nintendo cartridges and how ugly some of those like 80s. I actually really like that look, you know,
Like the label artwork or the actual box.
The actual, like, I guess the label artwork, maybe.
Yeah, some of that label artwork is trash. Like, you go and look at, like, Super Mario All-Stars, like, Super Nintendo cartridge label, or even the box artwork. The way they've drawn the characters, it's like they didn't know perspective exists. Like, it's really... Because obviously it's been hand-drawn and then digitized for print, like, or just hand-drawn and scaled up. Because, man, that stuff is... some of it hasn't aged well, but it does give you a certain feeling. It does give you a certain feeling of nostalgia, regardless of whether you played it as a kid or not.
Right. Yeah. And I think just kind of moving, I don't know, I guess subconsciously back in the day, I just had that type of visual in my head. And when I was studying in design school, you know, everyone was talking about, oh, like, you know, we got to go flat because it's more communicative. It's things like controlling color is so much easier. Manipulating anything in the design space, the design rules is so much easier to do in a flat minimal space than it is with a crazy skeuomorphic space. And that was a time when iPhones were at iOS 3, I believe. And that was all the icons were skeuomorphic. Do you remember that? Like you have a realistic.
When did Instagram come out? Was that iOS 3? I don't remember, but an example of that kind of skeuomorphism, would it that be the old, like the original Instagram logo? Is that kind of skeuomorphic? Yeah,
like a realistic camera.
I think maybe we've neglected something here, Michael. What would you define skeuomorphism as for those who don't know? Because we've been talking about this word for a few minutes and I've realized that we might know what it is, but maybe people at home don't. So how would you kind of define it in your own words?
I would say it's just another way of saying it pertains to interfaces. It's a term that people use in UX design for the most part. And I just think it's another way of saying hyper realistic looking things. You know, like if you were to make, and that's how all the old apps look like. They had very realistic looking buttons with, you know, realistic highlights and shadows coming out of them. And, you know, if you would think about it on paper, it's like, if the button looks real, it should be identifiable for you to push it, right? Like on an interface. But if you see like 50 of those buttons on one thing, it's really hard to distinguish from one and the other. That's why with something that's like a flat design, it's really easy to pinpoint one icon, one button from another icon. Hence Apple's iOS, when iOS 7 came out, I believe that's when they started going flat. And that's when you can see like, oh, the clock looks like a very minimal, very contrasty in color. And, you know, and it just pops right at you. Like, yeah, maybe execution wise, it looks very simple. But communication wise, it's so much easier to point these buttons out than it was back then, even though maybe execution wise, it in a skeuomorphic way, it was probably a bit more impressive. You know what I'm saying? I guess that's how I would define what skeuomorphism is. And I think it kind of started with what Apple was doing. I don't know who came up with that term. I don't know the history of it. But
it's a really interesting art style. I'd suggest, obviously, you can go and look at Michael's work online, but there are other, obviously, those old app icons as well. Now, one of the ways I like to kind of see it and interpret that art style is like faux 3D. It's designed to look like a real object, but it's also completely flat, because if you took out all the shading and all the gradients and all the color things that define those different areas, it would be a completely flat icon. And that's something that you do as part of your process, right? So you start with a very flat design and then build up layers of texture and shadow and depth.
Exactly.
So
that's exactly what I do, yeah.
So what does that process look like from like start to finish? Do you, as an illustrator that works with vectors, which often is quite uncommon in itself, because if I, with a girlfriend, Lydia, being an illustrator, the majority of almost, I don't think anyone on her course or anyone in her circle uses a vector tool to create their artwork.
Right.
They all just rely on very high resolution images. So obviously vector, go on.
Oh, no, I'm thinking that's probably one of the bigger appeals to why people like my work is because they're like, they look at it and they're like, why would you even do that on a vector platform? Or like, I can't believe this thing is infinitely scalable. You know, like execution wise, yeah, it'll take maybe a quarter of the time if you did it on something like Procreate or even Photoshop with a pen tablet or something. But I think that's, yeah, the fact that it is infinitely scalable, and it does have a unique look if you stick to the limitations of Gamut and Color and Illustrator. It gives it a very unique look as far as like, it looks real, but it's obviously not, you know, and it has that, like, you can see the separation the separation in blurry shapes. You can kind of see the banding in there. Like, I think a traditional Illustrator might be like, oh, that looks crappy. But like, I think I kind of like it in a way where it gives it character, you know?
I think it fits your aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like, if you were to shoot a film camera, right? It's like some of the limitations you have on a film is that actually gives it character, you know? And that's why people still shoot film, and that's why people, you know, like, there's a whole culture behind that too. So I don't think Illustrator has a culture like, hey, skeuomorphic.
Oh, I think it does, mate. I think there is an Adobe culture, that's for sure. More like an Adobe monopoly, but no politics today.
But yes, right. I just like how things look with these kind of, like, Illustrator has that weird limitation in color gamut, and I really like the results of it. And it all started when I worked for this candy company, and
oh, we're finding it. Origin story. Okay, guys.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Timestamp. Timestamp. Origin story.
Because, like, I made everything. I was very much a traditional designer before this job. Like, I would do everything very communicative, very infographic-like. And then I worked at this candy company where we were doing packaging for, like, Wonka products. And okay. I don't know. Is Wonka in the UK, or like
we have a bit of it. Like, it's not like actual Wonka, obviously, but it is branded that way. It's all right chocolate. It's like, it's okay.
It's the mass produced stuff.
Yeah, it's a bit meh.
And like Wonka, Crayola was one of the.
Crayola
was one of the clients in this.
Oh, candy. I see. I thought you meant like Crayola chocolate. I was like, mate, you can't eat those crayons. Like,
you know what? I'll tell you what. That was Crayola's issue.
Were eating them.
They were making these candy products, and the packaging would look just like their crayon boxes. You know, and you know, people wouldn't know if these things would be edible or not.
A dumb move! Like, you just put your crayons next to the edible snacks, and they look identical.
Yeah, line is gone. I don't think it was very successful for them, but But yeah, it was a company that made candy packaging.
Right, okay. Like confectionery stuff, yeah.
Like, yeah, Hasbro, all these kind of companies. And then they had their own line of candy companies, or candy products too. And I remember I would do all that flat, really designy looking stuff. And then my art director, Rosa, shout out to Rosa. She was one of my favorite bosses of all time. She'd be like, I see what you're doing. It looks really cool, but kids don't buy this shit. You know, kids like to buy things that look really realistic, cool looking sometimes with like realistic shadows. And then you want to make the background yellow because kids always want to buy yellow candy packaging.
Big, bright colors. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's when I was like, oh, man, but I hate doing all that crazy highlights and shadows and stuff. And then I hate using the freaking gradient mesh tool. It's the freaking worst. And then she showed me kind of like an unorthodox way of blurring highlights and shadows, with using a Photoshop method in Illustrator, Gaussian blur.
Yep.
Which is technically a raster, but if you save it as a vector smart object, it renders like a vector. There's like this weird hack to it. And when you blend these shapes together, you get that really cool banding effect that I was talking to you about with the limit of gamut color and everything. So I learned it from her, and I really liked the look of it, and I just kept on taking it to the next level, to the next level, to the next level, till the point where I don't know if I enjoy doing it that much anymore, but you know, that's why I moved over to like the paper stuff and applying some of those principles to that. And then you know, I just try to find ways to evolve this look as much as I can.
Well, it goes back to the point we made earlier about plateauing. If you whether that was recorded or not, I don't know. But if you get stagnant with something or stale or complacent with something, then you're just going to end up going backwards eventually. If you're not trying to improve what you create kind of 1% a day or trying to improve your stuff on a regular basis, it will actually deteriorate. So it's something that James Clear talks about in his book on habits, which is kind of comparable, that if you are getting 1% worse every day, by the end of the year, it's something like 99% worse. But if you get 1% better every day, it's like 350% better or something. So if, as you're talking about that, thinking about your process and how you go from start to finish, what does that look like? Because if you're not, do you do kind of hand sketches and build that out first and then go through to flat design and then your skeuomorphism, your textures, your other textures and layering and techniques? How do you create something from start to finish, Michael?
Oh, you too. That's a... I'll tell you why this is a hard question for me to answer.
It's does it because, change all the time?
It does. Yeah, like sometimes I just feel more excited to jump into the skeuomorphic stuff. And then once I'm finished with that part of it, I scale it down to something minimal. Like sometimes I like doing it that way. It makes more sense, I think, to most people to start minimal and then to scale up the detail from there. But I don't know. I guess for me, like what makes me work through a project faster is how excited I am to do it. And I know that sounds very selfish, but I think, I don't know, with creativity and illustration and this type of thing, I feel like your motivation level is kind of, to me, it's very important, you know, motivation to start and finish a project. And if I feel more inspired, I guess, I hate using that word too many times, but if I feel more inspired to do something and I see the visual of it in its realistic form first, sometimes I would do it the way that does not make sense, you know?
So sometimes like some people talk about, and I've done this in the past where I like to, for the explanation purposes, I'll keep it simple with a logo design idea, but sometimes people will just jump straight to digital, and that's fine. If you know exactly what you're doing and ready to go, then go for it. But so typically, let's think about this kind of on your average across the plateau, like across the board process. Do you start with kind of sketching things out, or do you kind of imagine that idea in your head and you can translate it in basic form to digital straight away?
I would say maybe about 60 or 70% of the time I start off with a sketch. And my sketches are very, very basic too. And then you can even see like on some of the slideshows that I put on Instagram, like you can see my origin sketch on a lot of them. And a lot of them are very, very basic. And I only make the sketches to give me a guideline of, okay, this is kind of how I want the composition to be. And most of the time it ends up different, you know, when I finished a project. And that's my biggest difficulty with clients is because we kind of, once we get to that rendered spot of things, it's really hard to edit things at that point, you know? So we kind of have to nail either the flat or the sketch part as much as we can. But yeah, I would say about like 60 to 70% of the time I start off with like a very minimal and basic sketch. To just give me the idea.
I do the same. If you go and look at some of the most prolific designers out there, their designs and sketches are just cheap, cheerful, down on paper in a really quick fashion. They're not designed to be anything that is the final idea. And I think that a lot of people mistaken that, particularly through Instagram and or visual platforms in general, that your sketch is not meant to be the final thing. Like if you're not doing that kind of tweaking in process, you're not getting feedback from the client, you're not building something out that's going to be slightly different than your initial idea, literally the scribble on a piece of paper. I think it's, I was actually watching some stuff. I mentioned him a couple of times on the podcast. I think his name's Eco Sato. I probably butchered it, but he's the owner of Nendo, which is like a product company in Japan. And if you go and look at his sketches, it's about three lines. He does about three lines on a napkin and he's like, this is it. And then he'll maybe draw an arrow with a word and that's it. But the idea yeah, you found
I'm looking at it for now.
But his sketching style is very minimal, very basic, but the final product he makes in the end is incredible because he's just, he's done is extracted the initial idea onto paper to get it out. And then when you've got it out on paper, you can do exactly what you're talking about, Michael, which is build it out from there. And it's much easier to expand it from kind of a scrappy idea on a piece of paper than it is the mess kind of floating around in your brain.
Right. Right.
So that's really good to hear, though, because I think often when you see, obviously you share some of your process stuff on Instagram as well, but when you often see just the finished product, it can be very, not just disingenuous, but it can be very deterring to some people to just be like, oh my God, how the hell did they kind of build this out? How did they make this? How did, like, all this stuff? And I mean, the techniques you've been talking about, they're all available in Illustrator. Yeah. It's not anything that is like a plugin or anything like that. It's not something you're going to go above and beyond to learn or know how to do, but you've just taken it in a way that is a little bit more experimental, and you've tweaked and you've tried. And obviously working for a confectionery company had some impact there, because your audience wanted that. Obviously you're aiming at children at the time, but your work now is drawing towards that nostalgic childhood feeling. So although you're not aiming at children anymore with your artwork, it does hit that same or very similar spot. And that's very unusual to see, but it's also nice to see and nice to hear that your process is not unlike other people's. It's not some like you throw ingredients in a pot and you put your wizard robe on and like stir a big stick and
I was actually teaching Illustrator yesterday, just to like a group of three people, and what did we do? We made a skeuomorphic ball, like just you know, kind of what you do in art school, how you make a ball to learn how where the highlights and the shadows would be on a ball, on a spherical object. We did that, and then they were like, "That's all you do?" I'm like, "Yeah,
that's all you do." I mean, don't like crash, like they're just like slapping you, really, like your craft is worth nothing, Michael.
So used to that at this point where it's like, I would get people on Instagram like, "Oh man, I worship you. Please teach me, master." Blah, you know, all that type of stuff, and then I show them, this is how you do the rim light on the paper thing, and they're like, "That's it." I'm like, "Yeah, motherfucker. That's exactly what you."
You should like make an ebook, man. Just make like an ebook that get people like hooked into a newsletter or something, and just be like, "Hey, I will teach you some of the techniques in Illustrator, and just do like step one, make a ball. Step two, do these highlight things. Step three, blur them."
I would tell you that's a very disheartening thing, though, is when you think you're giving someone exactly what they want, you're giving them the value, and then their response is like, "I knew that. I should have, you know what?" You know, like that response.
I think it's different if someone's like, "Oh, I should have known that. Like, I could have worked that out myself." Yeah. But it's like saying, a few years ago at the Tate Modern in London, there was just a mirror. Like, it was just a beautifully framed mirror on display. And that was a piece of art. And people were like, "Oh, I could have just done that. Like, why is that here?" It's like, well, you didn't think of it. And you didn't. And you didn't, like, contact the Tate to get it put up.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't make the necessary steps to put two and two together. You might. Right. It's like, you can't. If you're not going to execute on it, it doesn't matter whether you had the same idea. Like, 10 million people could have thought of the idea for Uber, but only one person actually executed on it.
Yeah, there's so many people that are like, "Oh, yeah, that's a common one." And people are like, "Oh, I thought about the Airbnb. I thought about that, you know? I thought about making an app for that." But yeah, at the end of the day, you're not the one that did it, because there's a lot of other behind-the-scenes things that deterred you from doing it. So... anyway, yeah, that's a very disheartening thing, though, is when you feel like you're helping someone out and they just kind of spit it back at your face.
I mean, I'm sure that's probably once in a blue moon or a bit of a fluke, because if I was sat in that class with you, I'd be like, "Hell yeah, I can do a ball now." Hell yeah. Like, I can do a ball. I can draw a ball.
You can draw a ball. Dude, all the techniques I do are actually very basic. It's just a lot of it.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that's really what it boils down to. It's just... it's just a lot.
There's just a lot of steps.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully you'll find some people who really want to soak up all your knowledge soon. And I mean, if you're going to do that again, like, you should 100% like send me an invite next time. That would be nice. Thanks.
No, for sure. You know what? No, for you know, back just to backtrack a little bit, most people that I do show this stuff to are very appreciative.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's always like, you know, it's that thing when you're doing when you're looking at your Instagram comments, it's like you see a million positive things. It's the only one you remember is that like one negative one where it's like, oh man, hey. Like it's just, that's pretty much the situation I'm describing right now. But hey, yeah, dude, I would be happy to go back to London and do a little demonstration again.
Oof. Get a workshop in London. That would be pretty sick, wouldn't it?
That would be great.
Well, keeping things moving on a workshopping, doing talks type note. Good segue. you, at the time we're recording this, today is the 14th of April. It's not, the episode's not going to be coming out in time, but you're doing a talk next weekend at CropCon, which is a design conference run by Matt Dawson.
Yeah.
And I know when we spoke in London, you were hoping to do more of this type of stuff moving forward.
Right.
And kind of branching yourself out from just doing illustration and artwork and that type of thing.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about that and what maybe spurred that idea?
Yeah, I think it always comes back to what I enjoy doing most. And that design school that I went to school at, I was actually a teacher there for 3 years or so. And then I never did it full time. And the money wasn't even anything that kept me teaching. You know what I mean? It wasn't that much money. But I enjoyed doing it, and I enjoyed just like that that expression, you know, in people's faces when they're like, oh my gosh, I can't, there's so, like, it, you open a whole world for them, you know? And then to, I follow up with a lot of my students still and to see what they're creating now, that like that type of feeling, you know, it's just such an awesome feeling. And I want to, and I was talking to Scotty Russell. Do you know who Scotty Russell is?
You've mentioned him before, and I think he's written down in my notes somewhere, but I haven't looked him up yet.
Oh yeah, he's a really awesome hand letterer and an awesome coach too. Like, he does a lot of this coaching stuff, design coach stuff. And I was telling him that I'd like to hit more than 40 people at a time. You know, I'd like to, you know, a conference is probably the next level at that, where you're talking to maybe 200 or more people. You know, so that's kind of a fear thing to get over, is like, I don't think I've ever spoken to a crowd that long for like over an hour. You know, that's that large. So I don't know, there's just a lot of aspects of it that excites me, you know, like I really want to be able to speak to all these people at once, you know, and then and also get over this fear of public speaking to a large crowd. You know, I think that's that first of all, that excites me. And secondly, it's just the impact that I could possibly have on these people too. So, I think the next step after that is to do kind of what you're doing right now as like a podcast, but some type of outlet like that, where I do more educational type stuff.
That was going to be my question. Is that the end goal? Is that to kind of branch out into something a bit more educational, kind of spread the message, share what you know, empower other people? Because if you're taking great satisfaction in helping other people, obviously the next logical step is to get over any public speaking fear and any fear of being on camera, which you obviously you don't have like at all. But it's for public speaking and stuff, that's a whole nother story. But when you've got over that hurdle, that's like that opens so many other doors. So is that the ultimate goal then for you, do you think? To do a bit of designing, but also to help empower other people too?
Yeah. I'm really working all this stuff out now. At this time, it feels like that's the way it's going to go. Cause, I think a YouTube channel would be really cool. I'm a very visual person. I was thinking of, I mean, I bought all this podcast gear, but I think at the end of the day, like, I do like being a bit more like being visual, just because, and it's a lot more work, you know. I'd rather like editing videos is such a pain in the ass. And I'm like, you know, all that storage space from all that London footage, you know, and all the storage space from all this other footage I'm sitting on. I don't know what tangents I'm going on, because we're actually going into a realm right now where I'm really just working things out. And I've had a lot of struggles with clients too, not really on the process stuff, but more on the motivation side of things, I think. that could be another factor on why I'm moving this way. I also feel like, and we touched up on this, like I'm a very unorthodox person, and I feel like I can give people insight on these unorthodox ways, you know, like for example, I've started and stuff when I was 29, 30-ish, and I'm 35 now, so I can help people have a 5-year plan like that, you know? So that's one of the biggest pieces of value I think I can give someone right now, rather than like, here's a tutorial on how to make this in Illustrator, or here's a tutorial. You know, I feel like there's bigger value on motivating someone to do all this stuff, and then for them to develop their own type of style, or develop the own type of stuff that they like, rather than be like, hey, this is exactly how I do things, copy me.
Yeah, you know, like that's yeah. There's a lot of value in that. There's a lot of value in the big picture stuff.
Yeah,
because it's I kind of to swing this on my perspective. I get and have had lots of questions in the past of, hey, would you do tutorials for stuff? Hey, would you do this? Like, would you? And I'm like, no. Like, just literally go to Google and type in how to learn Illustrator. And I'm not trying to be mean, but it's like, I have no desire to do that kind of thing. I want to share big picture stuff. I want to share stuff that I've done wrong and helped people got over, like stuff you don't get taught typically, which sounds to me like what you want to do. Whereas you can find a 600 part series on how to learn Adobe Illustrator if you really want to, but I'm not going to make it.
Exactly. And it's, I honestly think it doesn't help them. You know, if you give them a tutorial of exactly how you do things, like, oh, here's step by, I'm going to draw this rocket right now, guys, follow me step by step. I think that will help you in a very low level sense to like get a few techniques down here, you know, that, but it's not nothing that you can't find elsewhere, like in Skillshare.
Do you think your teacher at university was doing that? Because if your opinion you've just stated there is that having a very direct to the point, hey, follow my steps and copy this.
Yeah.
When you've learned the fundamentals, which is like learning the software or learning basic hierarchy and composition, do you think your opinion now reflects what you learned in university with your teacher who didn't give any briefs or didn't gave a very wide brief? Is that kind of the same mentality?
I think again, you kind of just hit the nail, you know, with that. It's actually just yesterday I was telling you, I was teaching these guys Illustrator and design stuff. Right. And this one of them was like, hey, should I take this course? It's like $500. It's a extended university course, you know, and it teaches you everything in the suite, like a Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign, and it's for one whole week, and then you get a certificate afterwards. I was telling her that like I almost find no value in learning the programs, because I feel like anyone can be a professional at learning how to be a production program person in a month. I think a month is all you need. If you were really driven and really wanted to learn Illustrator or Photoshop, you can do so and do it in a way where it's fresh in your mind and you know more than most people within a month. You know, that's why I hold more value in the courses that teach you the principles, that builds your foundation to get that aesthetic. I actually really hate it, and I hear it a lot when people look at some person, like an aspiring designer, and they tell them like, hey man, you just don't, some guys just don't get it. Like, they don't have the eye for this thing. It's like, yeah, maybe they don't have the eye now, but that's something that they have to develop. And if you're teaching them Photoshop shit all the time, not going to develop it, because you're training them to be a very technical, very production-based person. You're not training them to be a conceptual.
Training them to be an art worker, not a creative.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the end of the day, I don't want to talk too much shit about school, but that's what school wants you to do. They want to train you to be placed, because it makes their school more relevant. And what kind of jobs place you in the entry level? It's the production stuff. So that's why they give you certificates and like, you know, they know like the chances of you landing that creative director job straight out of school is very, very low. So they're going to train you in something that makes you a bit more marketable, that pays you a ton less, you know? So I don't know if I made, that's kind of like a mini rant on school. I don't know if that made sense.
It does make sense. It's really interesting, because it's a very similar approach to what Christo has. The art school is important, design school is important, but it's not your only avenue. And I feel the same way. I mean, I am actually considering going and doing as I think his name's Dan, there's a guy on Skillshare who's like an Adobe certified teacher. And if you go and sign up and get a free month of Skillshare, you can go and learn most of the, or whichever Adobe program you want within that month. Like I did an Adobe design, InDesign course with this guy. And within 3 or 4 days, I was up and running with InDesign. Like it's not, if you can spend that time, you don't need to spend $500, or in some cases in the UK, you'd be spending maybe 40, 50,000 pounds to go to university by the time you've got student loans and housing and university costs. And like, you don't need that. Now, not everyone's circumstance allows them to do that at home. Not everyone's circumstances fits this criteria. Maybe university is a better option. But for the sake of self-learning and learning these like these fundamental software and design skills, you do not need school. You can do that at home. And often school is better for networking. School is better for someone giving you a creative brief or giving you no brief and kind of expecting you. But at the end of the day, you can do that at home as well. So I'm very on the same page as you for this. I didn't go to university, but everyone I know who went to university, 9 out of 10 of them are not using their degree now. And by the end of their course, they felt that they had wished they'd done something else. So
that sucks.
it does suck, but that's just the way the system is. Like, if you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be an accountant, like all these very traditional business related or medical related or science related, so kind of like math, science, English, like those, or those kind of humanities even, you need like a degree, you need one. But if you want to do creative stuff, you really don't. What you need to show is that you can solve a problem.
Right. That portfolio is really the thing that drives you. And just to backtrack on that a little bit, like I do feel this way about school. I actually had a very positive experience from the design school I went to. So I'm not trying to deter anyone from going to design school. But I would say though, when you go, if you make the decision to go to school, is to be in a state of learning, you know, and to be as open-minded as you can be. And if a teacher is not giving you the stuff that you feel like you should be getting, then maybe you take the role of extracting that out of your teacher, you know, like, cause that's the same mentality I had. Like I was older when I went to design school, I had that Pirate's Code mentality. Right. So my whole goal was to get value. I sat in front of the class, every single class I've had, I've sat in the front. I've only hung out with the killers in every class, you know, the ones that were driven. Like the people that coast and, you know, was just going there because, I don't know, the government's paying for their school or something and they don't really care. Like I never hung out with those guys. I only hung out with the people that really wanted to, you know, that really wanted to succeed. Just surrounding people with that like-minded, you know, that mindset. Like you. That's why I hung out with you guys in London. It's because you guys all have this like-minded
for sure thing. Like
I'm not going to hang out with people that you know, that look down on this stuff, you know? So
exactly. You need that mentality. And I think ultimately that mentality is what will carry you, because you don't have to have the most incredible artwork, but you do need the ability to talk about it. You do need the ability to be driven. You do need the ability to go 10% further than everybody else, because that's all it takes. It's all it takes. It's just to be 10% harder working, or 10% better at talking to people and dealing with clients, or 10% better at marketing yourself. That's all it takes. And
seriously, yeah.
Like, we can go into this topic forever and forever and forever now, but it's really cool to hear that that's where you want to kind of, to backtrack completely, to hear that that's where you want to take your content and what you make in the future, how you want to take things forward. Because to not focus so much on the little kind of, it's not trivial, but like the little foundational stuff that anyone can teach, and focusing on something that is bigger picture, I think is really important, and I think is based on your personality, man. Like, I think you're going to do great at it. And how you share that story, I think, is going to come down really well. Now, thank you for talking to me today. I really, really appreciate it. We're going to wrap the show up here.
Oh, well, it's really 11:15.
Really, man. So where can people find you, and what's coming up?
Oh, man. It's funny. You caught me in this weird shutdown mode time. Or like my... my focus is more on like staying a little off the grid and just traveling and doing these talks and stuff. But at the same time, okay, Instagram is the main thing right now. So Fugs at Fugs Trader, that's just something that I will probably support until Instagram dies, probably, you know. And then the next thing to look forward to is a YouTube outlet, probably on IGTV, where I do a lot more of this educational type thing. And we talk more about, you know, that mental drive, because it's, I feel like everything is like 90% mental. You know, if you figure out the mental side, like everything kind of just comes into place.
It does. So, awesome. Yeah. So thank you for all those show notes. The show notes will have all of those links in them. So you can go and find Michael and all of his artwork and upcoming stuff there. Now, if you were at CropCon, because this episode is going to come out after, if you were at CropCon this year and you're listening to this episode, please send me a note on Instagram on my DM box. I'd love to hear how Michael's talk went from your perspective. And thank you very much for tuning in to this episode of the Fowler Hour. You can find me at CFowlerDesign. You can use the hashtag Fowler Hour on any social media and I will pick it up. I'd love to see Instagram stories of you guys listening to the show. And if you're listening to the show on a platform that allows you to review the podcast, I would super appreciate that as well. Those rankings really help people find the show and explore it and get into conversations like this where we rant about school and all that type of stuff. But anyway,
you know what? This is probably the darkest I've been on. Not dark. I think I like that we've talked more about this mental value stuff. Usually when I get on a podcast, it's about half an hour of just getting off track and
mate, like, you know? That's what I love. Yeah. And that's exactly what we're going to end the show on today. So thank you very much to everyone who's joined us. Michael's going to be back at some point, that's for sure. We'll see you guys next time. Bye.